7 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. This hour, we visit with University of Illinois Communications Professor Robert McChesney. He's the co-author of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And Professor McChesney joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Welcome to you, Robert McChesney.
My pleasure, Joseph.
And welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Bonnie.
So before we get to your book, the elections were held around the country yesterday. Any comments on the role money played in them? And if you want, you can focus on Virginia and and New Jersey.
Well, Virginia, I think, jumps out. I mean, I think in the book we write, Dollarocracy, is about how money has overwhelmed our politics, and those with all the money control our politics, hence the title Dollarocracy. And what we see now, and I'll give it an anecdote, then I'll go directly to Virginia. About a month ago, we were on the book tour trail, and someone came to our talk who works professionally representing candidates, organizing campaigns for liberal Democrats, sometimes even third party, but mostly very liberal Democrats. And this is what this person does for a living. And he told us that he's no longer can accept candidates unless they're already millionaires. Basically, you've got to have enough money to come in that he doesn't have to worry about raising that first amount of money. He's got to know you've got enough money to pay to play to be a candidate before he'll go out and try to raise more money. So it's sort of gotten to the point where even people who are opposed to money in politics have to have money to be legitimate candidates, is what, in effect, what he was saying, that we have a place where only the wealthy get to be candidates, get to hold office, not only give money to candidates. And when you look at Virginia, what you see with Terry McAuliffe is that he is sort of like that. He is a guy who's never held office. He has no particularly known record as an administrator, or as a public servant, or as a visionary that you can sink your teeth into that will qualify him to be governor of Virginia. But he has one great skill that he has demonstrated, which is he's a tremendous fundraiser, especially for bagging money from big game corporations and wealthy individuals. And that in today's politics is what makes you a serious candidate. So he outspent his opponent by a great deal and very effectively, from what I understood. And he needed to spend every dime he spent, it looks like, to win that race.
Now, in the subtitle of the book, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America, that term destroying America, isn't that a bit strong?
Yeah, it is a bit strong because I think we've got a lot at stake here. It's strong, but it wasn't meant to be hyperbolic. And I think, you know, when you read the book, when someone reads it and you see what we're talking about, everyone says, yeah, I know how money in politics, it's bad, but that's just the American way, and it's just sort of, we always muddle through. Well, it isn't the American way. And I think the history we show in the book is that what we've departed on in the last 40 years is very different from American history. It's also strikingly different from all the other nations that are on the Democratic grid. We're spending vastly more money on elections than anyone else has spent. For example, Germany just had national elections about 2 months ago now, and the Merkel government was reelected. And for every dollar they spent this year in the national elections in Germany on per voter, for every dollar spent per voter by the campaigns and parties on the election, in 2012 in our national elections, just for Congress and for presidency, we spent roughly in America $34, 34 to 1 ratio. We outspent Germany $34 to 1 per voter in our campaign. And our campaign was, you know, I think our turnout was 53% of eligible voters. Germany, which was complaining about their low turnout, had 72%. We haven't seen 72% in a long time. We had 72% here. Chris Matthews had been cartwheels down Fifth Avenue. I mean, no one would believe it. They'd call a national holiday. And so we destroy America. I think what you look at it, our governing system, the idea of democracy, the rule of the people, elections are the one moment when that actually does take place, when Bill Gates and the heirs to the Walmart fortune are equal to the person who cleans the toilets at Walmart on the graveyard shift. They have the one vote each. And when we lose that, and that's what we're losing in Dollarocracy with all this money and with voter suppression on the other side of the coin, then we lose that one link that does keep the control of this country in the hands of the people. And if you believe that is America, and I was raised in an idealistic home to believe that, then it's destroying America.
You've been working on your book pretty much since the Citizens United ruling. Was that your impetus for writing Dollarocracy?
Yeah, John Nichols and I are political junkies. We're best friends. We live in Madison. I teach at Illinois, but I've lived in Madison many years, and we stay in constant touch. So we're constantly talking about money, politics, races. And we always knew we were going to write a book because we were concerned about political advertising and the decline of political journalism going back to the 90s. But then I think when the January 2010 Supreme Court decision was Citizens United, which effectively allowed large corporations, billionaires, to spend as much as they want on political campaigns. And to be fair, the decision also allowed labor unions to spend as much as they want on political campaigns. And for some of the younger listeners, you might have to ask your parents what labor unions are. But, you know, that triggered everything, because then we ended up with the election of 2012, where we spent roughly 10.5 now, and the number keeps going up because we come up with new stashes of money with every filing we get to. But $10.5 billion was spent on the 2012 election, state, federal, local. And that was double what was spent just 4 years earlier. I mean, it was, you know, and again, as we've already talked about Germany, we're way off the grid there. So Citizens United triggers the moment we're in, and it looks like, just based on the spending we've seen already in 2013 compared to 2009, that we could conceivably spend as much in the off-year elections of 2014. We could spend another $10 or $11 billion there, even without a presidential race, which would be like three times what we spent in, say, 2010. The money is simply catastrophically out of sight.
Well, it makes broadcasters happy. How do these hungry 24-hour news cycles and pundit programs affect the electorate? Does it polarize people more?
Well, the way it makes broadcasters happy is that they're the ones who get most of this money. So of the $6 billion spent on political advertising,
but not
most
public
of it ends
broadcasters.
Up, not you guys, unfortunately. No, just commercial broadcasters. And, you know, the average commercial television station got 2 or 3% of its revenues from TV candidate ads in 1992. By 2012, the average local commercial TV station was getting between 20% and 40%. Of its revenues, depending on the station, from TV candidate ads, from political advertising. It became this enormous cash cow that has elevated this huge industry to become this really lucrative industry that otherwise was in decline. So our political system is subsidizing this already coddled industry. And it also means that the National Association of Broadcasters, the Commercial Broadcasters Trade Association, is now and has been for a while to campaign finance reform in the same relationship as the National Rifle Association has to efforts to control guns.
So you talk about the death of commercial journalism going hand in hand with this spending. Is that what you mean?
Well, yes, it is. To one extent, you see it because when commercial stations and public stations get their license from the Federal Communications Commission to one of the scarce frequencies available in a community, like in Miami, the theory is the reason they get that license is they'll do something in the public interest. They won't just be out to maximize profit. And when the courts and the Federal Communications Commission have actually explained what is that public interest, the number one thing on the list is always coverage of local elections, candidate debates, interviewing candidates, letting people in the community see who's running for office, and they can go to the polls knowing something thanks to their television stations. And as the money has increased to commercial broadcasting in the last 20 years, so it's now the number one source of revenues type of advertising they get, almost all commercial stations, the actual coverage of races in terms of journalism, in terms of airing debates of candidates, interviews with candidates, free time to candidates, has virtually disappeared. It barely exists. So it makes the power of the ads that much greater. The other side, though, and this is even more striking, that wouldn't be that big of a deal if we had a rigorous, vibrant political journalism in our newspapers, magazines, and online on websites, so that people wouldn't have to rely on ads, or so that the ads would become laughably absurd because you'd know you'd have journalism, which is sort of explaining what actually was going on in the race. And the great crisis we chronicle in the book is that concurrent with this influx of money, we're seeing journalism in free fall collapse in the United States, because the commercial model of journalism, which we've had for the last century, which produced great fortunes for many businesses and business families, that model is now dying a rapid death because of the internet.
So Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith goes to Washington to go get things straightened out is horribly naive.
Well, you know, I'm not one to kick sand on Jimmy Stewart. I'm a big fan of his movies. But, you know, I think right now it's not naive, though. Actually, I'd say it isn't naive to think that we can organize to change things. And that's really the argument we make in the book. Our book is not trying to get people depressed and to go find the nearest ledge to jump off of. In fact, we'd argue that what's really impressive that's going on in America today is there's this considerable uprising going on at the grassroots that's not funded by any foundation or any powerful group, that's all citizen-driven, that's trying to basically say we've got to get our political system out of the hands of moneyed interests. We've got to basically have one person, one vote be the way our elections are decided now instead of $1, one vote. And it's, you know, we've already had 15 or 16 states which have petitioned the U.S. Congress formally to say they want a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. We have had over 500 communities all across the country, all of every political persuasion, vote to overturn Citizens United in form of constitutional amendment. John Nichols and I have researched this, and we can't find any other moment in American history we've had a constitutional amendment spread like wildfire like this. And so I think there is a chance for grassroots activism here, but it's going to be a tough fight. But people are concerned. And this is not a nation that's happy with its state of affairs. And a lot of people are getting off their butts and doing something about it.
We're speaking with communications professor at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, Robert McChesney. He's the co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back and we'll open the phones and take your email. Stay with us. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper. We're visiting with Professor Robert McChesney. He's an author and a professor, and he wrote with John Nichols, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. If you want to join in the conversation, you're welcome. The number is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio at WLRN.org, radio at WLRN.org. Professor, you say the internet's evolving in a manner that's destructive to democracy. In what ways does the internet need to be reformed, and how can that be accomplished?
Wow, what a doozy of a question, Bonnie. Yeah, that's a whale of a question. Let's put it this way. Back in the 1990s when the internet came along, and I was there, and I suspect a lot of your listeners were, What immediately captured people's attention was that the control was in the user. You could pick where you went. You saw everything anyone else could see. You controlled what people knew about you. You had the power. You could do what you wanted to do on the internet without having to get any permission from someone either, unless you were going to break the law, but that would be the case anywhere. As long as it was legal, anything went. So it seemed like something that was driven by individuals and gave them all the power. And I think that model has been turned on its head. And it's been turned on its head because that's not a very lucrative model for businesses to make profit. And so the big companies that have come to dominate the internet in the last 5, 10, 15 years, depending on the company, the Googles and Facebooks and Apples and Amazons and Microsofts, they have learned that, you know, the way to maximize profit on people is to convert the internet so you can track them and know everything about them. And then you can use that information to sell products, to coax them to do what you want them to do, and to create services you think they will enjoy. I mean, that's how they would frame it. So people who go to the same web address will get different home pages depending on who they are. They'll know already ahead of time. You have your own personally crafted internet created for you. But it's where the power has been shifted out of your hands into other hands. And I think we're beginning with the NSA scandal to get a handle on just what this means in terms of shifting the whole logic of the internet. And I think a lot of the debate now, the healthy debate that's growing out of the Snowden revelations, is getting people to say, okay, maybe we've got to rethink exactly what we're sacrificing here as we go forward. And in the book, and this is where it really relates to Dollarocracy, we have a whole chapter on sort of how the internet is affecting the money and media election complex. Will the internet bail us out? Will the internet, as it replaces television, get us to the point where those negative ads won't be watched. They'll have nowhere to go. And it'll be like the good old days of the internet. We can go on and we can fact check candidates. We can see what they're saying and judge for ourselves. We can have access to a broad range of information. And we can return and have a really great democratic electoral culture thanks to the internet. And regrettably, what we see and what we write about in the book is that money is flooding the internet and conquering it for election campaigns, much as it has broadcast television, in ways that are at times frightening. And I think now with the NSA scandal, we can get a sense of how what politicians can do with this information. And the campaign that did the most by far in 2012 successfully with the internet and really understanding how it's evolved was the Obama campaign, which some experts in the Romney campaign think their internet usage was the difference for why they won the campaign, that they had so mastered the internet compared to any other previous campaign. Because what Obama did, his campaign did, is they took all the information they had on voters from online and from all their other sources, from interviews and offline. They put it all together for the first time on one cloud, the Amazon cloud. So they had it together, and they had thousands of great scientists with algorithms and supercomputers play with that data. And they were able to come up with basically between 1,200 and 2,000 points of information on every American voter. And they could craft messages to people that would know, you know, exactly what words would use, what issues would use. And they did it mostly as good cop stuff in 2012. So that's why it wasn't very controversial, because it was mostly trying to get their own supporters to give them money to go out to vote. The other shoe's about to fall, which is when people start using it to, like, negative ads, to get people not to vote or to explicitly mislead people they want to get vote for them. Because what you can do with the new technology, and this is what is most frightening, I think, to people in the industry, is a candidate can send different messages to everyone and basically shape a message to an individual knowing exactly what issue they care about and saying, that's my position. And if you do that to 100 to 10 million people, there's no way, we can't even police political ads already on the air that everyone sees and that you can record. How on earth can you possibly police bogus emails that basically are full of nonsense? They're really completely at this point unaccountable. And it's where our politics is rapidly evolving toward. And it's really something people should keep their eyes on.
Our telephone number, 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Robert McChesney, tell us more about what you talk about in the book of these coin-operated think tanks. What does that mean?
Well, what we did in the book is, you know, we tried to put the current dollarocracy in historical perspective. And our argument is that there's always been a tension in America between wealth and privilege in one hand and democracy in the other hand. It goes back to the founding of the country and the debates that led to the Constitution and the first generation of the Republic. But they really intensified after the Great Industrial Revolution and the Gilded Age of the late 19th century. And if you look at America from 1900 to 1970, there were periods of great reform, tremendous political upheaval, the Progressive Era, the New Deal, the 1960s. And there were a lot of great victories that were won. We won the right to vote for women, the right to vote for African Americans in the South, for Latinos, for Native Americans, for people 18 to 21 who couldn't vote but could fight in wars. Tremendous victories were won. And by 1970, a lot of Americans, including myself, I was 17 at the time, were very optimistic that this country had the ability and the capacity to solve its problems. It could really go forward in a progressive manner, become a much more democratic place, that we were leading the world. And that's the way, that's what America should do. But not everyone was optimistic in 1970. Specifically, the American corporate community was very pessimistic about its state of affairs. And it looked at America and saw that business was at a low ebb in terms of its popularity, especially among young people who were middle class and upper middle class, who traditionally were the strongest proponents of a business society. And they became alarmed that they were losing any control over the government, and the country was moving away from being a capitalist society as America has known it. And they wrote a number of reports. One of them famously was called The Crisis of Democracy, in which business leaders argued the crisis of democracy in America was there was too much democracy. Women and young people and African Americans were getting too involved in politics, making demands on the system. And if America was going to be healthy and have its type of democracy they wanted, it had to get those people back in the couches and let business take over the government again.
Who wrote this report? Excuse me. Who wrote
that?
That was
actually done by the Trilateral Commission, commissioned that report in 1975. The report we talk about mostly in the book, to devote a chapter to it, was commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1971 and written by Lewis Powell, then the leading corporate attorney in the country. It was a confidential memo, only 6 pages long. You can Google it and find it. And it was distributed to maybe 50 or 60 of the leading CEOs and billionaires in the country, including the Koch brothers. In that memo, which we devote a chapter to, basically it was a blueprint for how corporations take over the government and make sure that no matter which party wins the election, they still control everything. They're never jeopardized, their control over the country. And this is the long way of answering your question, Joseph, because what Lewis Powell called for in that 1971 confidential memo was the creation of all sorts of think tanks to sort of promote the business good, labor bad, regulation bad point of view. It called for setting up something like ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, to write legislation, have business write legislation to give to legislators so it'd be already be do the job for them. It called for radically expanding corporate lobbying. In fact, there was a tenfold increase in corporate lobbying in the 2 decades after Powell's memo was circulated among corporate leaders. And so this whole period of dollarocracy we have, of unlimited spending, is part of this broad movement. Powell would later go to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was appointed by Nixon, approved by the Senate 99-1, which did not know about this memo he'd written only a few months earlier. And Powell became immediately the champion of having unlimited spending by billionaires and corporations on politics. And he didn't get his way till Citizens United. He couldn't get a majority in the court. But from the beginning, Powell understood that if business could have unlimited spending on elections, its chances of having favorable governments would go way up.
You and your co-author, John Nichols, co-founded the organization Free Press. So you've been leading this battle against media consolidation, but media consolidation has been continuing. So what can be done?
Well, you know, Free Press began 10 years ago. In fact, we're having our 10th anniversary celebration tomorrow night in New York City. And we began, and the theory behind Free Press was that the policies that are made in Washington that create our media system, broadcasting, the internet, the works, are made behind closed doors by powerful special interests. And the public really doesn't know anything about them and doesn't have any voice in them. And the idea of Free Press was to organize people so there'd be an effective public voice in these debates on media ownership, public broadcasting, the works. We thought there had to be a public voice. And I'm proud to say that we accomplished a lot. And we were able to stop, actually, the worst media consolidation efforts and the worst mergers. I know it's hard to believe when you look around, but it would actually be worse. We were able to prevent government propaganda in some cases. We've been able to protect the
What mergers did you block?
You're hitting me on the top of the head. The last cell phone merger that was like a year or two ago between the big cell phone companies, we stopped. I think it was the T-Mobile deal at the time. And there have been smaller deals with broadcasters. Yeah. There have been smaller deals with broadcast companies that have tried to sell and do mergers over the years, too. But the point I get at, and this is really where it gets at the issue at hand, is, you know, we got inside the Beltway and we had some success. And I think we put too many of our chips inside the Beltway and we lost sight of the fact that inside the Beltway, the game is still completely controlled by those with money, absolutely controlled that way. As one person at Free Press put it, his work sense on the Hill, he says, the only difference between the Republicans and Democrats, when you get right down to it, is whether AT&T overtly or covertly writes the rules. That's really the difference. So they completely own the board when it comes to the internet. So I think right now what we're trying to do with the group is we go more to a grassroots to really get people engaged again on core issues and not get too hung up on sort of the minutiae of policy matters, but big issues about what sort of internet we want, what sort of journalism we want, what sort of public and community media we want, which is one of our big issues, the importance of having credible, vibrant public and community media.
We're visiting with Professor Robert McChesney at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, along with John Nichols. He's written Dollarocracy, How the Money in Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We need to take another break, and we'll return. And welcome back to Wednesday?
Wednesday, I believe.
It's Wednesday's Topical Current. Sorry about that. And Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we're visiting with Professor Robert McChesney, from the University of Illinois, who, along with John Nichols, has written Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. If you want to join in the conversation, we do have lines open. It's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. And why don't we take a call?
Okay, we've got John in West Palm. Hi there. John, you're up.
Yes, okay. I'm really enjoying this show. But practically speaking, obviously I'm a Democrat, but practically speaking, as long as the Republicans control Congress, I don't really see any hope of change. During the recent shutdown, I was amazed at the power that the Speaker of the House has. If he decides he doesn't want to put up for a vote, it's not going to happen. And I don't know how that's going to change when their vested interests are, of course, the high-dollar organizations. And I'll listen. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Professor?
Well, that's a great question by John, and is a legitimate concern. And I will only say that it's not purely a Republican-Democrat issue, although mm-hmm. Republicans, certainly modern Republicans, are much more comfortable with unlimited money, because I think, opportunistically, I think it helps them win elections. It's just like Republicans almost exclusively are in favor of voter suppression tactics, because they realize it's Democratic votes that are being suppressed. And I think that's purely opportunistic on their part in both cases. But Democrats are very much part of the system as well. And while they will give great lip service and pronouncements about how they really don't like the money system, the actions speak louder than words, and we haven't seen a whole lot of action there. I think the most impressive Democrats tend to be the backbenchers who aren't in anywhere leadership of committees or president or in the cabinet. And, they're part of the system as well. Barack Obama got almost as much money as Mitt Romney, and the newer research shows that a much larger proportion of that came from big donors than it did from the small donors. So I think the challenge is creating a bipartisan movement, and I think that's an effort that's going on, and it will be disproportionately liberals and the left, I think, guiding it for political reasons. But it is a movement we're finding as we do the constitutional amendment work that appeals really across the political spectrum the further you get from Washington, D.C.
Are you really confident that the constitutional amendment's going to pass enough states, or will it go the way of the ERA in the 70s?
That's a great question. I think first of all, even if it goes the way of the ERA, that's fine. Not fine, but that still could be a great accomplishment in the sense that what a constitutional amendment does is it draws people's attention to something, a dramatic idea, draws people into the debate who wouldn't pay attention otherwise because they think, oh, that's something I can sink my teeth into. And even though the ERA didn't win, it really, there were a number of great reforms like Title IX and a series of reforms affecting women's status in our society that only won because there was a movement that organized behind, that was drawn together by the ERA, that had created a lot of political pressure for women's groups and feminist organizations. So even if you don't get the amendment, you can have very positive political organizing effects on legislation. But I'd also add that, it is difficult to pass constitutional amendments, but, we've done it 27 times. The framers did it 10 times in the first 4 years of the country. And if you look at American history since the middle of the 19th century, we have had four great reform periods in American history. We've had Reconstruction, the Progressive Era, the New Deal in the 1960s. And what's striking, if you look at those 4 years, each of them had at least three constitutional amendments passed during those eras. All of those constitutional amendments were thought to be impossible to pass right up until when they were passed. And then they got passed in these sort of moments of reform. And so the constitutional amendment approach will work if we go into another great reform moment.
Of course, only the prohibition amendment and presidential succession and terms have passed that weren't amendments that actually gave more freedom rather than restricting them.
That's right. Usually amendments that pass are things that are expanding democracy, expanding democratic rights, and in moments of reform. So, I think if we have a reform moment, and if that's the question, similar to the ones I just described, or even maybe larger, then it's logical we will probably have constitutional amendments. If we don't have a reform moment, it's almost impossible to pass one. I think when you look at what's going on in America today in terms of growing inequality, increasing poverty, how the inability of our political system to address basic fundamental existential issues like the environment, I think we're, the stars are in alignment for there to be a dramatic upheaval. And our job is to try to prepare for it so that it's humane, peaceful, democratic response to the crisis.
What about the right to vote?
I'm a big fan of that. You know, this is one of the things that's striking. Most Americans don't realize there is not a right to vote in our mm-hmm. Constitution. And, you know, it's funny, when America invades another country or wins a war with another country like Germany or Japan or more recently with Iraq, we always put a right to vote in the Constitution. We understand that that's a central democratic right in all every other constitution. And most Americans assume we have it in ours. We don't, which is why all these voter suppression techniques that are being implemented exclusively by Republican governments to make it harder for poor people and people of color and young people to vote mm-hmm. Are possible. They would be unconstitutional if we had a right to vote. So there are several amendments we talk about in the book, but the right to vote and have your vote counted for every American citizen we think is absolutely imperative. And I think that's one, I'd like to see someone oppose that.
Ben wants to know if there are parallels between what you're advocating for, especially regarding your organization and increased citizen involvement, and what Ralph Nader's been trying to do for four decades. Can the professor evaluate Nader's accomplishments or perhaps shortcomings in his bids for the presidency?
Sure. Ralph Nader is what he's tried to do in his career, early in his career in particular, is exactly the sort of principle we're doing here. And, you know, Ralph Nader is an interesting figure. And I think he's a tone-deaf person politically in terms of electoral politics. He'd be the last person I would hire to sort of give me political analysis if I wanted to run a successful campaign or be successful in electoral politics. And I think, unfortunately, people are going to remember that Ralph Nader of the last 10 or 20 years to the detriment of the fact that in the 1960s or 70s, he was the most respected American by far in public opinion polls across the political spectrum. For a generation of Americans, he's taught that public service was an admirable thing to do and that people could come together and have the government actually solve problems and make the world a better place in a democracy, which was a revolutionary idea. And it's worth noting that in the chapter 3 of the book where we talk about Lewis Powell and the corporate response to the 1960s, they didn't really care about SDS and the New Left and Maoist and all that stuff. They thought these guys were wacky. They were scared to death of Ralph Nader. He absolutely terrified the Koch brothers in corporate America, because he was convincing average, everyday Americans across the political spectrum that you could actually make a democracy work on behalf of your interests, not, you know, that it could be a positive force. And that was something they wanted to see purged from the American mind.
And let's go to Harvey. He's in Key West. Hey there.
Yes, I think the House of Representatives should be chosen every 2 years from a jury list of people who are average citizens, and they are given a letter in the mail. You are now chosen to serve for 2 years, housewives, bankers, garbage collectors, and then average citizens would have their shot at glory unless they had a valid excuse like you serve on a jury when you're required to, and you'd see some big changes. It could almost be like a satire, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, but the truth is that average people would probably have more common sense, and there could be a permanent group of bureaucrats who guide an average housewife on the issues. Well, this bill is coming up, this is the issue, this is the past history of it, but it would be 2 years of service from average Americans, and that would change things greatly.
Maybe you need to watch out what you wish for, too.
Well, you know, it's funny that Harvey should mention that, because in the book we talk about surveys, ask that exact question. Would you rather keep the current system, or would you rather just have the Congress selected by drawing names out of a hat, like a jury? And something like 47% of Americans opted for the jury approach. And it's not as ludicrous an idea as one might think, because if you look at the first great democracy we talk about, ancient Athens, it was the jury that actually was where the power lay, and it was that principle that it should just be random selection, so to speak. But I would say at the same time, I'd like to think that we've gotten to the point where we could actually structure democracy so we could have effective representatives. I mean, it's sort of an admission of the corruption of our system, we've abandoned all hope of electoral democracy. If we look at other countries and we look at our own history, I think we can find there are ways to actually have an effective functioning democracy that doesn't require basically just drawing names out of a hat.
But if ordinary citizens were serving, you know, the old adage that power corrupts, once they get into power, they don't want to lose it.
Yeah, you know, I think it sounds good. And it's actually used as a joke line that people would rather have a jury system. But yeah, it still invites all sorts of issues and all sorts of problems. Clearly, the sort of bureaucrats who are advising the people who are just there for 2 years would have immense amount of power framing the issues for the representatives.
Kopis says, wouldn't direct democracy take the wind out of the sails of representatives who can be bought off? The internet would make it possible for everyone to vote directly on issues.
Well, I think that there's an element where that could be very true eventually, possibly. And I'm a big fan of expanding direct democracy. I think it's going to be a long time so that we wouldn't have representatives at all. But I think the point I really like about that question is we should be thinking about ways to effectively expand and make effective democracy. And you know, the type of democracy we have in the United States today is so far from even rudimentary theory that and Americans don't often see that. There were two studies that came out in 2012 published by Princeton University Press, one by Marty Gillens of Princeton and another by a team of scholars at the University of California and a couple other schools. And they were the leading political scientists in the country, and they both reached the exact same conclusion independently with all their research, which is really hard quantitative research. They both concluded, if you look at the policies of the U.S. government today, they are made exclusively to serve the interests of wealthy people, you know, the people, the funders, the people they hang around with, the lobbyists. And the interests of poor people, working class and middle class people have absolutely no effect on the decisions that are being made, the key decisions made by Congress. I think that's the crisis we're in now. It's very severe.
We're speaking with Professor Robert McChesney from the University of Illinois, and along with John Nichols, they've founded Free Press Organization. What is the website for Free Press, by the way?
Freepress.net.
Okay. And they've written Dollarocracy, and we're going to take one more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Professor Robert McChesney. We're talking about the book he's co-authored called Dollarocracy. And we'll have links to that book on both the WLRN.org website as well as the Topical Currents Facebook page. We have a few lines open, 1-800-743-9576, if you'd like to join in. And we'll move along to Scott. He's in Hollywood. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
You got me. Good. Dollarocracy is a great name for the book. I was saying to the pre-interview person that you had on there, you know, in a nutshell, we're losing our society because of what's going on, and you know, dumping all this money, the political action groups that we have, and the lobbyists, and all this unlimited money is leading to the I think to the death of what our society is right now, and it's falling apart. And why is it? I was talking with a few friends of mine. We were discussing this, and we asked ourselves, why is it, you know, why can't the politicians be given, either from taxes or from the government or from the people, an equal amount of money going into the any election, whether it be president or senator or even mayor, an equal amount of money, and let them run on this equal amount of money and no more money, and let them, you know, speak the truth. And I know that the truth and politics in Washington, they just don't mix, but there must be a way that we could get this done. I just don't know how.
Professor?
That's a terrific question, Scott. And yes, we can solve it. I mean, there are ways to have great elections with lots of good ideas that don't involve lots of money. In fact, money, what we've learned in politics, like we learned the comparison to Germany, but it's true of any major democracy, the more money that gets spent doesn't improve the quality of the election. It ruins it. It destroys it. It produces lots of negative ads, ads that are illegal in Germany or Britain or most other democracies. They're considered like toxic germ warfare to conventional military operations. So we can solve the problem. Now, the issue here, though, practically, is that the Citizens United decision, which culminated really about a half dozen major decisions going back to when Lewis Powell joined the court in the late 70s, these decisions have switched the whole way America approaches elections. So no longer is it the right and responsibility and privilege of our Congress and state legislators to set the terms of elections to guarantee one person, one vote, which had been the rule really until the 70s and especially by 2010. But instead now they said it's a constitutional right of rich people to be able to spend as much as they want and corporations to spend as much as they want on politics, which makes it very hard to do a legislative reform that might stop the ability of wealthy people to buy elections. So that's why so much emphasis now is going on the constitutional route.
And we'll move along to Ann in Hollywood. We're getting short on time, Ann. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I don't think Congress should be passing laws that they don't have to participate in. I mean, they serve one term. They get a pension of their full salary forever. They don't participate in Social Security. They get these Cadillac health care plans that the rest of us would be paying taxes on very shortly, I believe. And why can't they just get everything that everybody else has? Why shouldn't they be in Obamacare like everybody else?
Well, that's orthogonal to the book, but I agree completely. And I think there are actually a couple principled members of Congress who don't take the health care plan for that reason. I've shared Brown of Ohio, I know, is one, but I think there might be some others too. And but I agree that especially people, you know, what I'd also like to say, I'll take it one step further. I'd like to say every member of Congress who voted against that food stamp increase, I'd like to see them try to live on a food stamp budget for a week or two just to try it out, see what it's like, and then pass judgment on how much money that they were cutting and how that affected people.
Absolutely. I also think they could save Social Security by changing it and make it some kind of donut hole like they did with the drug plans, where you pay up to $100,000 in salary, and then you get a gap until you hit $250,000, and then you keep paying Social Security on all that forever.
You and I are on the same page on a lot of issues. They aren't really the subjects of our book, but they're the issues that we ought to be discussing in a democracy. You know, we shouldn't be discussing Chris Christie's waistline. We should be discussing things like Social Security and how to make our government function to solve the problems we have in this country that government needs to solve.
One last caller, quickly. Jeff, Fort Lauderdale. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of comments and then a question. First is, it seems to me I've been quite involved with advocacy over the past few years, and as I've gone to the fundraisers, it always occurs to me that each dollar that you give is sort of like a nuclear arms race. One of the candidates gets a dollar, the other one needs $1.50. And they're constantly in a very difficult position, the legislators are, the current lawmakers, and those that want to be elected, in order to try and come up with the next dollar in order to win over their opponent. As an example, in the last race, Rick Scott spent $100 million of his own money to become governor of the state of Florida. It's remarkable how much money is involved in the politics, and it seems to me that up and until the media, who has been decimated by the internet in reducing their advertising dollars, they are the ones that are going to perpetrate the money in politics. And then the last comment is that, in my view, it is as though that each of the people who have this amount of money disenfranchise all the other voters, because it seems as though that somehow or another their vote is more important than everybody else's. Thank you.
Great comments. Let me just say that I used to give a lot of donations to candidates in years past, and I sort of stopped doing that, not because I don't care about elections, but because I'm so frustrated with the fact that, you know, in a close race, probably 80% of that dollar I give is going to go to pay commercial broadcasters to run ads, and I just think it's obscene that I'm
negative
paying
ads.
Or even if they were positive, I feel like, but they're almost always negative. But it's just that I'm bankrolling commercial broadcasting industry. That's where that money ends up. I might as well just write a check directly to Gannett or Belo or one of these companies or Sinclair. And, you know, and I think that that response I have, and that I think that Jeff had in his comments, is that this is what's going to be happening to a lot of smaller donors. Is, you know, your enthusiasm to give that $50 or $100, when you start getting into these $10, $12, $15, $20 billion elections, and when you hear about people like the Koch brothers, who now we know gave $300 million in the 2012 cycle, or Shelley Adelson, who gave $200 million. You know, your incentive to give money to run negative ads, I think you're going to see there's a lot of people who just jump out at the lower end of the system. There's really not a place for me in dollarocracy.
Do you happen to know the difference between 2008 and 2012 in terms of small contributions to President Obama?
You know, I've got the data. We have it in the book, and he did surprisingly well in 2012. People thought he would have a huge drop-off because there wasn't as much enthusiasm about the campaign. But because of their internet system became so good with, you know, they had a team of 20 people writing emails to go to Obama supporters, and they would, you know, they would try out test runs because they could do this now with all the data they have, and they would hone messages that were incredibly effective, that were personalized to people. So they actually came up with, you know, several hundred million dollars. They almost did as well, if not better, than 2008 because of that.
Oh, well, we've been speaking, very interesting hour, with Professor Robert McChesney from the University of Illinois, and along with John Nichols, who's the Washington correspondent for The Nation and associate editor of the Capital Times in Wisconsin, Madison. They've written Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We'll have links to the book on our website, WLRN.org, and on our Facebook page, and also freepress.net. Thank you, Professor, so much.
It's been my privilege.
And thanks for tuning in. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Also help from Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like. Tomorrow's program begins with an examination of personal fears. Public speaking, heights, crowds, flying. Also the lowdown on the world-famous Joe's Stone Crab Restaurant. 100 years old now. With samples, we hope. Lyonnaise potatoes. And to the calendar, on this day in 1917, 95 years ago, the Bolshevik coup d'etat begins with the capture of the Winter Palace in St. Petersburg, Russia. And on this day in 1962, after losing his second election in a row, this one to Pat Brown for the governorship of California, Richard Nixon gives a concession speech and retires from public life. Well, for a while. And more while we recall anarchy in the UK. On this day in 1975, 38 years ago, the Sex Pistols, the pioneer punk band, play their first gig at St. Martin's School of Art in London. The originals, Johnny Rotten, Steve Jones, Paul Cook, and bassist Glenn Matlock. Sid Vicious would replace Matlock in 1977. Best known for their single in 1977, God Save the Queen. So we leave with the 1962 conclusion of Nixon's concession speech. As I leave, I want you to know, just think of how much you're going to be missing. You won't have Nixon to kick around anymore because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference. Stay with us for the next hour. It'll be Here and Now from NPR News.